What if the woman caring for your child wasn't who she claimed to be? What if her face was a lie, her name fabricated, her past a weapon, and the baby growing inside her wasn't just a child, but the key to your financial ruin? Evan McAllister was a high-powered hedge fund executive used to control, precision, and luxury. After a messy divorce from his emotionally unstable ex-wife, he thought hiring a live-in nanny would help stabilize life for his daughter. And at first, Eliza seemed perfect. Gentle, efficient, beautiful, and just distant enough to seem professional. But there was something odd about her familiarity. Something haunting in the way she looked at him. That's because Eliza wasn't Eliza at all. She was Camille, the younger sister of Evan's ex-wife, who had undergone plastic surgery, changed her identity, and embedded herself in his home, not to care for his daughter, but to destroy him from the inside. This story isn't just about seduction, deception, and betrayal. It's about how obsession weaponized the female body and turned motherhood into the ultimate con. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Perfect Stranger. Evan McAllister had everything a man was supposed to want. A corner office with panoramic views of Manhattan, a waterfront condo stacked with modern art and minimalist furniture, a luxury sedan with its own Wi-Fi hotspot, and most importantly, a brilliant 4-year-old daughter named Zoe, who had somehow remained untouched by the emotional fallout of her parents' divorce. What Evan didn't have, what kept him up at night, was structure, stability, as someone to fill the quiet spaces of their penthouse when Zoe napped or the markets closed early. His ex-wife, Marla, had left their lives in a storm of courtroom theatrics and tabloid gossip. She accused him of controlling her, of emotional manipulation masked as luxury. She got nothing in court, but plenty of attention from Instagram therapists and bitter women's podcasts. Evan just wanted peace, and Zoe needed a caregiver, a woman's touch, someone professional. Enter Eliza Hammond. She came recommended by an elite agency that specialized in executive domestic solutions. British-accented, soft-spoken, and armed with a resume of pediatric certifications, she walked into the McAllister penthouse in tailored navy slacks and a cream blouse that whispered class, but not seduction. Her file was pristine, CPR certified, multilingual, and trained in childhood psychology. Zoe took to her immediately. Within a day, the girl was calling her Zaza, a toddlerism Eliza never corrected. By the third day, Zoe stopped asking when mommy was coming back. Evan noticed the little things first. The way Eliza folded the kitchen towels into perfect thirds, how she used chamomile to calm Zoe before bed, or how she adjusted the stroller harness without being asked. Her presence was like a subtle perfume, undeniable, but never overpowering. Still, there was something strange about her familiarity. Too many coincidences. One morning, Eliza hummed a lullaby while brushing Zoe's hair. Evan froze in the doorway. It was the same song Marla used to sing, word for word. "Did Marla tell you that one?" he asked, feigning casualness. Eliza paused. "No, it's just something I picked up during training. It's common in English nurseries." Later that night, Evan shook it off. The world was small. Maybe Marla wasn't as original as she liked to think. Still, something in Eliza's gaze gave him pause, an intensity, a hunger, maybe even recognition. He couldn't place it. That's because Eliza Hammond didn't exist. She was Camille Leclerc's, the younger half-sister Marla had refused to claim in public, a girl born from their mother's second marriage to a French musician who left when Camille was 7. While Marla had taken to private school and Botox before 20, Camille had been the invisible one, bookish, quiet, awkward. the one Marla mocked, ignored, and once accused of trying to seduce Evan at a holiday party. It wasn't true, back then, but Camille had watched Evan for years, studied him, listened through walls. She saw what Marla never appreciated, his discipline, his composure, the way he touched his cufflinks before a serious conversation. She remembered the time he helped her reach a glass on the top shelf, the gentle, careful now as he passed it down. That was the first moment, the moment she knew he could be hers, if she were someone else. The transformation took 3 years, 2 major surgeries, chin and cheekbones, a minor brow lift, voice lessons, contact lenses. She gained 10 pounds and dyed her hair. She forged a new identity in a European clinic and used her inheritance from their estranged father to buy silence. Then she planted her new resume in the right inboxes. The rest was performance, and Evan never suspected a thing. The first physical touch was accidental. Her hand brushed his wrist while handing him Zoe's reading log. He said, "Thanks," without looking up. The second time, she lingered, a little longer, a little bolder. He started leaving the office earlier, brought home wine, asked her opinion on Zoe's school, instead of defaulting to his lawyer's assistant. One Friday night, after a particularly bad market downturn, he found her sitting on the balcony with a glass of red. "Do you always look this calm when the world's on fire?" he asked, loosening his tie. She smiled. "Only when I've survived worse." That was the night they kissed. She didn't lean in. She waited. Let him reach for her. Let him believe he was the one crossing the line. They slept together 3 nights later. It was quiet, urgent, neither romantic nor sleazy, just necessary. Evan called it blurring the lines of comfort, then rationalized it as a grown-up connection between 2 responsible adults who cared for a child together. Camille, Eliza, said nothing. By the end of the month, they were sleeping in the same bed 5 nights a week. Camille had planned it all down to the ovulation window. She swapped out his condoms, researched his sleep aids, adjusted the bedroom thermostat to encourage spooning. By the time she peed on the stick, she already had her speech rehearsed. "I didn't mean for this to happen," she whispered, holding the test like a guilty secret. "I can leave, if you want." Evan said nothing for a long moment, then, "No, stay." He didn't ask if she wanted to keep it. He didn't suggest alternatives. She offered no assurances. It was like they both knew. This was happening. But while Evan spiraled into a quiet crisis, Googling paternity laws, scanning prenups, consulting his accountant, Camille acted calm, unshakable, as if she'd known this life would happen all along. She took over Zoe's pediatric appointments. She redecorated the nursery before Evan even asked. When he had a 3 a.m. panic attack over child support projections, she rubbed his back and whispered, "You're not alone in this." By the time the second trimester hit, Evan had proposed. The ring was simple, no fanfare. He slipped it into her coffee mug one morning, and she laughed so convincingly it made him cry. They never even told Zoe. She just started calling her Mama Eliza one day, and no one corrected her. Camille was already moving money. The access came gradually, an emergency card for baby supplies, a login for the household budget, a signature authority for Zoe's education fund. She hacked his brokerage accounts on her own, using remote desktop software while he showered. She didn't take much, just enough. Enough to test the water, enough to prepare an exit route. What she didn't anticipate was how much she would begin to enjoy the role. The power, the freedom of finally being seen, not as someone's backup, not as a secret shame, but as the main character, until the ghosts began to return. Marla, the ex-wife, she resurfaced with venom, drunk calls, social media rants, drive-by screaming fits from a Range Rover parked below the building. Evan brushed it off, but Camille saw the danger. She staged her own break-in. Late one night, she smashed a bedroom window from the outside, ransacked a drawer, and left behind one of Marla's old scarves, which she'd stolen years ago. The next morning, Evan called the police. Camille sobbed in the hallway. A restraining order was filed that afternoon. Everything was going to plan until Camille made a mistake, a small one. During a playdate, another mother asked how long she'd worked for Evan. Camille smiled, since Zoe was a baby. But Zoe was already two when Eliza Hammond had been hired. The mother raised a brow. Camille corrected herself quickly. Sorry, I meant... Since she was out of diapers, I still call her a baby. It passed. Barely. But Evan's assistant, Laura, overheard it. Laura, the nosy, overqualified Cornell grad who handled all of Evan's PR. The following week, Evan was informed that Laura had opened a private investigation into Eliza's credentials, just standard practice, something for legal compliance. Especially with a child and assets involved, Camille panicked. She needed to bury the truth before it surfaced. She fabricated a miscarriage scare, doubling over in the kitchen, screaming for Evan, clutching her stomach. At the hospital, she insisted on Evan staying by her side. When the ultrasound showed a healthy baby, she cried from relief. Evan melted. While he was distracted, Camille remotely accessed Laura's work laptop using credentials she'd previously skimmed. She deleted email threads, changed file names, planted phishing software. Still, paranoia bloomed. She began recording everything. Evan's calls, Zoe's tantrums, even her own therapy sessions, which she staged for narrative protection. And just in time, because Laura didn't stop digging, 2 weeks later, Evan received an anonymous tip. Eliza Hammond's nanny certification in London couldn't be verified. Neither could her paediatric internship. Evan confronted her, softly, like he always did when afraid he might be wrong. There's no record of your training. Camille played her ace. Tears, but not desperation. Hurt, she spun a story about a stalker. Said she'd legally changed her name to escape abuse, that the agency knew everything and had promised confidentiality. She offered to leave, pack up, take the baby, and go. It was a bluff, and Evan fell for it. He apologized. Again. Camille doubled down on the pregnancy. She bought baby books, set up doula consultations, and began sleeping in Evan's bed full time. No more pretense, no more folded blankets between them. But inside, she was cold steel, because Evan still had power, still had Zoe, and that wouldn't last. She began quietly building legal leverage, voicemails of Evan yelling, documents showing he'd missed paediatric appointments, a bruised arm she self-inflicted and photographed after slamming it in a cabinet. By month 8, she had enough to suggest emotional abuse if needed. Evan, oblivious, threw a baby shower. She wore white, glowing, victorious. But deep inside her purse, hidden beneath tissue paper and perfume, was a second birth certificate. For the child, with no father listed, the donor was anonymous, but selected carefully. Same hair, same skin tone, similar jawline, just enough to fake a match. The baby would be her ticket. Evan would believe it was his. And once the papers were signed, the estate updated, the press release drafted, she would vanish, not with regret, but with everything she'd ever wanted. Chapter 2, The Woman Behind the Mask. Camille stared at her reflection in the hospital's bathroom mirror, cradling her newborn son in her arms. The birth had gone as planned. No complications, no questions, and most importantly, no blood test. She insisted on an at-home paternity kit once they were discharged, citing privacy concerns. Evan agreed. He always did now. The baby, whom they named Elias, had just enough of Evan's features to silence any doubts, hazel eyes, an angular jaw, a faint cleft in his chin. But the truth lay deeper, in the invisible code of DNA. And Camille had made sure that truth would never be discovered. The donor's profile had taken months to secure. She'd searched fertility forums and backdoor clinics for a man whose genetic markers aligned closely enough with Evan's to fool any casual paternity test. She paid double to ensure confidentiality, triple to have the donor scrubbed from the database once the insemination was complete. Elias wasn't Evan's, but he looked like he could be, and that was all that mattered. The weeks after the birth were quiet. Camille played the role of overwhelmed new mother flawlessly, nursing schedules, postpartum tears, middle-of-the-night rocking sessions. Evan doted on her. He moved meetings, hired a night nurse, bought her a vintage necklace she pretended to love. By the time Elias turned 4 weeks old, Evan added her to his will. That was the moment Camille felt it. Victory. Everything she'd lost as a child, identity, control, power, had been reconstructed in this life. Her name was forged, her body surgically reassembled, her relationship built from illusion. But the results were real. Money, status, legacy. She had made herself a queen in a kingdom Evan didn't even realize he'd built for her. But power is a drug that demands escalation. Camille didn't just want comfort. She wanted full control. The penthouse. The child. The narrative. So she began phase three. It started with the nanny cams. She disabled two, rerouted one, and repurposed another to feed footage directly to a hidden drive. She began documenting Evan's habits, his drinking, his absence, his dismissive tone. She planted small conflicts, like arguing over Elias's vaccine schedule and recording Evan's frustrated reactions. Then she began a digital smear campaign, subtle at first. Anonymous social media posts questioning Evan's investment ethics, tips sent to finance blogs about undisclosed emotional abuse. She even created a fake ex-employee who claimed Evan fired her for rejecting advances. She needed Evan fragile and fast because Marla had resurfaced again, this time sober, composed and furious. The restraining order had expired, and she knew. Marla had seen Camille's face at a fundraising gala from across the room. The shape was different, the voice altered, but the eyes, those eyes, were unmistakable. She didn't confront Camille directly. She went to Evan. "You're sleeping with my sister," she hissed, storming into Evan's office unannounced. "Half-sister," Camille corrected later, when Evan relayed the outburst. "You lied to me," Evan said, his voice hollow. Camille said nothing. Instead, she pulled out a stack of therapy documents, faked ones, showing that she had changed her identity to escape childhood trauma, not to deceive. She wept. "I didn't think you'd accept me if I told you the truth, but everything else was real." Evan, ever the fixer, folded again. But this time, doubt lingered in his eyes. She could see it, feel it, and she knew what that meant. The walls were closing in, so she made her final move. Custody. She filed a preliminary claim for full guardianship of Elias and joint custody of Zoe, citing Evan's emotional instability and history of negligence. She attached screenshots, audio recordings, fake therapist reports. She built a digital case so convincing that even Evan's lawyer blinked twice when reading it. Evan retaliated. He filed his own motion, claiming fraud, emotional manipulation, and paternity misrepresentation. He ordered a court-authorized DNA test. Camille, unflinching, faked a lab clerical error, claimed the wrong sample was submitted, bought time. But Evan wasn't stalling anymore. He hired a private forensic analyst, began building his own case. He found old surgery records tied to her former alias, contacted Camille's ex-roommate in Paris, traced financial transactions to the donor clinic she thought she'd buried. When he confronted her, it wasn't with rage. It was with disgust. "You planned this," he said, throwing a manila folder onto the counter. "From the start." Camille didn't cry. She didn't deny it. She didn't beg. She simply stared at him and said, "And it worked." Evan looked like he'd been slapped. "You're insane." She tilted her head. "You're broke." And he was. The scandal had gone public. A leaked email from Camille's burner account, posing as Evan's mistress, made its way to an industry journalist. The headlines were brutal. Executive sleeps with fraudulent nanny, pregnant with mystery child, investors pulled out, his board ousted him. His partners voted to dissolve the hedge fund. The only asset left untouched was the penthouse, and Camille was still on the deed. She didn't fight for custody of Zoe. That would have looked greedy. She framed it as a mercy. "Evan needs her more than I do." Public sympathy shifted toward her. By the time the judge ruled, Camille walked away with joint custody of Elias, monthly support, a privacy clause, and full control of the estate held in Elias's name, an estate Evan had unknowingly transferred in a financial move months before the scandal broke. But there was one final twist. Evan requested one last private meeting. They met at a downtown cafe, surrounded by lawyers and silence. He stared at her with eyes that had once held warmth. "I know the child isn't mine." She didn't blink. "Prove it." He slid over an envelope. Inside, a second DNA report. This one from a third-party lab she hadn't intercepted. But the name on the test wasn't his. It was Marla's. Evan leaned forward. "She did her own test. She stole a hair from Elias. He's not even related to her, which means he's not mine." Camille went pale. "You played the wrong game," he whispered. But he underestimated her one last time. Camille stood slowly, smiled. "You can take the money back, the name, the house. But the boy, he's mine, and he's all I need." Then she left, and Evan never saw her again. Years passed. The headlines faded. Evan reinvented himself in consulting. Marla married a tech mogul and moved to Spain. Zoe grew into a quiet, watchful teenager. And Camille? She changed her name again. Started over in a different city. A different country. With Elias. And a new target. Because once you master the art of becoming whoever they need you to be, you never go hungry again.